EIOU is sponsored in part by the students of Lakehead University, our listeners, and our sponsors. At this time, we would like to thank the following sponsors for their continuous support.
Signal Resources Limited, Thunder Bay's locally owned and operated audio-visual professionals. Contact them about your next multimedia event or installation at 807-475-9341 or at signalresources.com. The Thunder Bay Community Auditorium. Find them at tbca.com to purchase tickets and find out all of the details on their upcoming events. Vox Popular Media Arts Festival, located inside Trinity Hall at 310 Park Avenue. Join the fun every September for the annual Media Arts Fest, entering its 16th year in 2020.
CILU now presents World in Progress.
DW, World in Progress. With Sarah Steffen.
Welcome to the show, I'm Sarah Steffen. For many of us, the Christian tradition of St. Nicholas means little gifts and chocolate. But for others, the tradition has a dark side. The Netherlands, Zwarte Piet, or Black Piet for instance, that depicts a helper of St. Nicholas dressed in blackface.
They don't see it as a racist thing. They see it as a children party. But in that period, they started to make stupid jokes about you as a black man.
The month of December in countries where Christmas is celebrated sees a rise in chocolate consumption, but it's a bitter trade for chocolate producers. Stay tuned for these stories and more, coming up on DW's World in Progress. Zwarte Piet, that's Dutch for Black Piet, has been a topic of controversy for several decades. According to the Dutch St. Nicholas or Sinterklaas tradition, Zwarte Piet is the helper of Sinterklaas who gives out sweets to children. The Sinterklaas figure, an old man with a white beard, usually arrives by ship and rides his horse through parades across the Netherlands. Adults and children come to meet him, dressed up as Zwarte Piet, donning blackface and black curly wigs. For years, critics have tried to stop this practice, calling it racist. A UN Committee on Racial Equality said the character reflected negative stereotypes and was seen as a vestige of slavery. That was 5 years ago. Now, due to the coronavirus pandemic, most parades have been cancelled this year. But the problem of racism in the Netherlands goes well beyond the controversial figure of Black Piet. Nicole Graf went to investigate, and her report is presented by Natalie Muller.
On a sunny day in August, a few young people have gathered in a park in the Dutch city of Maastricht. 39-year-old Kimothy Brown is sitting in a camping chair and reading from a children's book. Her 3-year-old son wriggles around on her lap. This reading group meets once a month and is organized by Black Lives Matter Maastricht. Megan Hitman explains.
Of course, it's not just for kids that are people of color, kids of color, but for anyone, because we will also be mentioning just equality, what's it like to live in a mixed society, and how to be more respectful to each other.
She shows a few of the books. They're children's books about well-known African Americans who can serve as role models.
Today the ones we brought is ones about Rosa Parks, Maya Angelou, Martin Luther King Jr. In schools we're not really taught about many people that are historical people that are actually people of color. So we want kids to actually know that they existed and also that they have someone to look up to.
The book they're reading from today is about friendship between children of different backgrounds and about their different cultural traditions. The children come from different backgrounds. Many of them weren't born in the Netherlands and don't hold Dutch citizenship, but they reflect the diversity of Dutch society. It's become more common to see a more diverse population on the streets of Amsterdam, Rotterdam, and The Hague. Rinesh Raghunath teaches Dutch online and lives in a small city not far from Rotterdam. His parents are originally from Suriname, a former Dutch colony in South America's northeast. He explains his lineage.
I think three generations earlier, they were from India. Because when the slavery time was banned, then it was contractors. But I don't think they were paid very well, and I don't think it was very as good as they said, as they were saying.
The contract labourers brought over from India weren't treated much better than the slaves before them. After Suriname gained independence in 1975, many migrated to the Netherlands and were given citizenship. Around 350,000 came over, but many people in the Netherlands don't know much about this history, says Raghunath.
You know, if I go to small places, then, hey, where are you from? It's Suriname in Africa. So they don't know. It's just ignorance. They just see all colored people as black.
Virgil Ernestina, a 46-year-old burly man, nearly 2 metres tall with a greying beard, is from the Caribbean island of Curaçao, which to this day is part of the Dutch kingdom, along with the neighbouring islands Aruba and St Martin. The islands are autonomous, though. Virgil came to Europe to see. Standing in the kitchen of his Rotterdam apartment, he talks about how his ancestors originally came from West Africa and were taken to the Caribbean as slaves.
Dutch people don't know nothing about the slavery, and that is also a big problem in the Dutch elementary. They teach the nice thing of kolonialism, they call it in Dutch. They teach, okay, Holland got rich due to trade with other countries, but tell you how the trade was. They don't tell you 1,000 slaves died on the route to America, Caribbean, those things they don't tell you. I think that must be part also of the education of primary already, huh? Because I teach my children about the colonialism and slavery, all those things.
Virgil has 4 children between the ages of 7 and 15. He teaches at a vocational school and lives in a tranquil part of Rotterdam filled with dark brick Hanseatic houses that line streets free of traffic. Virgil says he feels more comfortable in Rotterdam, which is multicultural, than in Zwolle, a small city in northern Holland where he lived for 20 years. He says it's very rural there and the education level isn't very high. He was one of the few people there who wasn't white.
There you can really see the racism. And you can really see also that the police treat you other like, for example, here in Rotterdam. When I was working as a consultant, I bought a car. It was an expensive car. But always the police were, especially when I was with my colored friends, police always pulled me over and asked me what... where I'm going, what I'm doing, you know. It did not happen at that time with the mother of my children. She also borrowed my car, and she never was stopped by the police. So she's white. She's Dutch, yes. Or when you go to a store, the one who's selling clothes, she was following you, those things.
In 2016, the rapper Typhoon was stopped by the police. The incident caused a controversial debate about ethnic profiling. According to a survey conducted by a well-known pollster, approximately 2/3 of Dutch respondents condoned ethnic profiling if it could prevent crime, even though it's an illegal practice in the Netherlands. Only 1/3 of the people surveyed said it was racist. But what happens more often than anything else are dumb comments, says Virgil.
Because sometimes Dutch people... they make jokes about your color. Hey, you went to Spain, okay. Yeah, you got dark, you got brown. And those kinds of stupid remarks over Santa Claus period. Yeah, okay, we need a Zwarte Piet. Can you play Zwarte Piet?
Yeah. In the Netherlands, Zwarte Piet, or Black Piet, is the man who accompanies St. Nicholas. The character changed in the mid-1800s against the background of colonialism and became a black man wearing a costume similar to what a servant would have worn. Every winter, there are St. Nicholas parades featuring a white Dutch person dressed up in blackface with pronounced red lips, Turkish pants, a black wig and gold earrings.
They don't see it as a racist thing. They see it as a children's party. But in that period, they started to make stupid jokes about you as a black man. I'm not against Santa Claus party because I used to celebrate it also when I was a little child. And I still celebrate it in my children. But they don't have to offend colored people.
Many people, not just people of color, are calling for the tradition of Black Pete to be put to an end. They say he should be turned back into what he once was, a man with coal on his face who went down the chimney. It's a topic that's divided Dutch society, because there are many who see it as a tradition they don't want taken away from them.
Achteruit! Achteruit!
Achteruit! Protests involving the people who want to keep him and the ones who don't have been turned violent. This year, the Netherlands and European countries have been having debates of their own about racism following the death of American George Floyd and the debate surrounding police violence against African Americans. Back in Maastricht, the Black Lives Matter group meets up again later in the afternoon for a protest. Around 50 young people, white and black alike, have gathered on the steps of the Basilica of St. Servatius in the city centre.
So for our next demand, it's written on that banner that those two beautiful girls are holding, and it's that Dutch colonial history and racism should be taught in schools and incorporated into the educational system.
A 26-year-old woman named Narval approaches the microphone and reads out another demand.
Our next demand is that the municipality of Maastricht is going to declare Zwarte Piet as racism.
Narval is from a small town outside of Maastricht and prefers not to give her last name. Her mother is from a Moroccan Sudanese family. Her father is white and Dutch. Narval was once one of the few children in her town who wasn't white, and she was confronted with racism at a young age.
I grew up in a little town. It was like more countryside. And my mom was one of the first black people. When my mom would pass by, they would grab their bags real tight and say like, oh, black person is passing by, grab your bag real tight. At school, they would tell like I was dirty, I was a dirty black person, I should go back to the country I come from, which is really confusing as a little kid. I was maybe 8 years old or 6 years old. Well, my mom, she explained to me people are being racist and I'm born and raised here and this is the country I come from and I should not listen to them and I should speak up, and so I did. But it's a bit unfair that you have to speak up in some certain way that you'd not choose to.
No life matter. Don't get to sleeping now.
Look what I'm whipping now. There are mixed reactions from passers-by. Some stop for a moment and listen to the protest. Others look on curiously but keep going. Others don't pay any attention to them at all. An older man loiters on the square for a while and takes picture after picture of the group. He doesn't want to give his name. When asked about his opinion of the protest, he becomes tongue-tied.
Don't make it too important. Two is always bad. And sometimes too much. For example, with Black Peter, it's overacting. It's just a tradition. It is not personal. Black Peter is not meant personal. If you understand the symbolism of it, it becomes quite different. It's stupid to make a point of it.
Arguments like these are very common, says Mashantali de Jong from the small left-leaning party By Aim.
So racism is done so ingrained that they can't even see that something is racist because it's part of their normal way of thinking. So that's what makes it so scary, that it's so normalized that people can't even tell when something is racist.
De Jong, like Virgil, lives in Rotterdam and is also originally from Curaçao. In addition to her work for the party, she's also a student and works as a model on the side. She says racism isn't a topic people like to talk about in the Netherlands.
That's, I think, the crux of the problem here in the Netherlands, that the way we really go into these conversations is already with the wrong intentions. People don't really have the capacity to really sit and talk about these things without taking them personally. People have learned racism is when you're racist, you're a bad person. You're calling me a bad person. Okay, well, I'm not a bad person, so it must be you. It's very childish. We're not talking about blame. We're talking about responsibility.
She says it's also really important in the Netherlands not to make conversations uncomfortable and to be easygoing. She says it's about being normal and being like everyone else.
We're not used to having to take this seriously, because it's literally what people will tell you, just take a joke. It's just a joke, or it's constantly coming back to the norm. Everyone has to be like the norm. Like this whole saying of do normaal, doe je ook gek genoeg. That's really important, because what it means basically just be normal, because being normal already makes you strange enough.
The Dutch tend to be considered open, tolerant and progressive. But from the dozen or so parties in Parliament, nearly half of them are critical of migration or reject it outright. The strongest party is Prime Minister Mark Rutte's People's Party for Freedom and Democracy, the VVD. They're economically liberal but socially conservative. The VVD wants to limit immigration and to do away with dual citizenship. It also wants migrants to assimilate into Dutch culture. And the way the party's program is worded, foreigners are seen more as a problem than anything. The second strongest party is Geert Wilders' Freedom Party, which is right-wing. Wilders is known for stirring up hate against immigrants, Muslims in particular, and he's already been convicted for incitement.
You're listening to World in Progress on CILU 102.7 FM.
While in Germany, right-wing extremism is closely linked to the ideas of National Socialism, in the Netherlands, the right-wing says it's defending European values as regards to freedom. And Muslim immigrants, more than anyone else, are the enemy.
Our Prime Minister can say things. I've seen him say things to international press that I'm like, you don't believe that shit. But he understands your image. That's important. And that's the thing. This country is all about image.
The Bij Een Party, the party de Jong works for, came about in order to give racism more prominence in the political debate. Its name, Bij Een, comes from the article of the Dutch Constitution, which makes discrimination illegal. Bij Een was founded in 2016 by TV host Sylvana Simmons, who herself is black. The party still hasn't made it into parliament, but as de Jong sees it, it's more than just a political party. It's a movement that wants to start a larger discussion across society and devote itself to other social problems too. Many things are interconnected, she says, like discrimination against job applicants and tenants, or a controversial practice of the tax authority.
It's a form of institutionalized racism, because what happened was that they would look at people, and people who had a different nationality apart from Dutch, they would get extra looked at. Certain brown and black countries. And oftentimes, it wouldn't even just be based on fact. And it was so bad that one person actually ended up killing themselves because of the fact that now they were basically said that they stole money from the government because they got compensation for child crèche. And they owed all of a sudden so much money. That was not true, but that was based because of this faulty ethnic profiling that they were using. One person lost their lives.
De Jong is also involved with Amnesty International. She goes to schools to give workshops on racism. And in a multicultural city like Rotterdam, she barely has a problem talking about the topic. But in rural schools with pretty much only white children, it's a very sensitive topic, and she has to tread lightly. De Jong starts by talking about examples of other stereotypes, like people with glasses are more intelligent. Then she lets the group choose between two pictures, a famous singer who's very good at chess, but people don't know it, and a girl with glasses.
We have like a thing beneath it, like who's the smartest? And most of the class always goes for the girl. Tell her, but why did you think that? And usually it comes back to the class, and I'm okay. I'm like, think about when you're growing up. You know, look at cartoons or look at shows. It's like, oh yeah, dad, they always put them in classes. Okay, so it's not just because of you. You already take the onus that is personally about them being at fault, and that makes it easier for them to understand and accept what you're saying afterwards. So it's really having to hold people by the hand, emotionally disarm them. No, it's not your fault. No, it's not about you. It's very emotionally taxing. But then you'll get somewhere that they'll be like, oh, I didn't think of that.
Rinesh Raghunath, the young man whose parents are from Suriname, believes that history is a key to the present. If you learn from it, he says, you can find a peaceful way to coexist in the here and now.
That's why you are multicultural. You know, there was colonization in the past because now you live together with foreigners. If some people are going to say, yeah, well, you're a foreigner, you shouldn't be here, well, that's the freaking history. Accept it. Your grandparents were a part of that, and it's not that you have to be ashamed or shameful about your grandparents. It's not about you, but it is freaking history. It's the past, and I want to change it in a better way.
Natalie Mahler with that report by Nicole Graf. There's nothing sweeter than chocolate, right? Well, that statement doesn't ring true for many chocolate producers in West Africa. According to a recent study, over 1.5 million children work in cocoa production in Côte d'Ivoire and Ghana. Cocoa farmers say they need the children because they don't make enough to employ farmhands. Now, the falling prices of cocoa and the COVID-19 pandemic has hit them on top of everything else. Ineke Mules has this report by Dunya Sadaki.
At a cocoa plantation in Côte d'Ivoire's southern Aboisia region, the police are inspecting the grounds for children who should be in school. It doesn't take long for them to find one. A little girl around 7 years old wearing a pink sweater is crying and clings to her mother. The mother says the girl hasn't gone to school this year because they didn't have the money. Still, Police Chief Rosa Kanda tells both of them to come to the police station.
We took the mother and daughter with us. The mother can show us that the child belongs in the second grade and went to school last year at least.
Child labour has been a big problem for a long time in Côte d'Ivoire. According to a recent study from the University of Chicago's NORC Research Institute, over 1.5 million children work in cocoa production in Côte d'Ivoire and in Ghana. The study goes on to say that more than 40% of kids between the ages of 5 and 17 work in hazardous conditions, for example at nighttime with sharp tools, or they're exposed to chemical substances. The study's findings are deplorable. The overall proportion of child labour has increased over the last decade, as has cocoa production. According to the Fair Trade Foundation, farmers only see about 6% of the total revenue. João Kofi Jean-Baptiste is a cocoa farmer in Tafisu, which lies in the heart of Côte d'Ivoire. He says many farmers simply don't have the money to employ farmhands. They themselves would have to earn double to secure their existence. He says the falling price of cocoa and the COVID-19 pandemic have hit farmers on top of everything else, despite the fact that the government set the price of cocoa at 1,000 CFA franc, or roughly €1.50 a kilo.
It's exhausting. The money isn't enough by a long shot. The kids have to go to school and workers need to be paid. We can't afford supplies. At least we had some money this year thanks to the fixed price, otherwise it would have been difficult. There isn't enough cocoa. The earth isn't as fruitful as it once was, so there's less.
Money is scarce and farmhands are expensive, which means that children often have to help out their parents on the plantation after school. Or they work on other plantations to help support their family. For years, human rights organizations have criticized the fact that chocolate producers like Nestlé or Mars could have put an end to child labor. Yet after 20 years of promises and a number of goals that were delayed, child labor remains a problem in the cocoa industry. But Bruno Alaton sees it differently. Alaton works for the International Cocoa Initiative, or ICI. The deputy country director for ICI in Côte d'Ivoire says there's been significant progress.
The cocoa sector has indeed promised to reduce child labour on the plantations. Efforts have been made and there have been positive developments. Access to education has markedly improved over the last 10 years, but we estimate that at the moment only about 10 to 20% of the cocoa delivery chain in Côte d'Ivoire and Ghana are covered by effective protective systems. Many of our partners agreed recently to considerable obligations in order to increase this coverage to put us on track.
Olatan says that chocolate producers have, for example, helped build schools and have helped increase the production of cocoa. The study from the University of Chicago also shows that the areas where companies have operated have seen a reduction in child labour. And that is the main source of criticism. The industry, with its billions in profits, could have done much more to improve the situation for the growers, so that today child labour would no longer be an issue. That would mean higher prices for growers, assistance for increasing production, stricter inspections and development programs in communities that produce cocoa. But the bigger chocolate consumers, like Europe or the US, would also need to hold them to account. The US Supreme Court is currently deliberating over whether chocolate companies can be held accountable for child labour on African plantations. In the meantime, Côte d'Ivoire and Ghana have reacted jointly. Since October, buyers have been required to pay a premium of about $400, or just over €330 per tonne of cocoa beans. And large chocolate producers have already found themselves under scrutiny for allegedly finding loopholes to get around these new prices.
Ineke Mules presenting that report by Dunya Sadaki. The COVID-19 pandemic is dominating headlines, world affairs, and our everyday lives. At the time of this recording, there were over 68 million documented global infections. Over 1.5 million people have died ever since the first cases were detected in China in December of last year. Here in Germany, we are debating how to deal with family gatherings over the holidays and whether we need a tougher lockdown to get infections under control. For some, all this talk about the coronavirus is just too much, and they want to hear none of it. A cafe in Italy decided to outright ban the topic. Megan Williams has the story.
It's late afternoon, shortly before the 6 p.m. COVID closing time in Italy. In a small, cozy cafe on the outskirts of Rome, coffee supplier Alessandro Pacifici swings by with his weekly delivery of beans and for a quick espresso. As he chats with owner Cristina Mattioli, he steers the talk clear of one topic that's top of mind for the rest of the country and much of the world. And that's because he's seen the signs posted above the bar that read, "Strictly forbidden to talk about coronavirus. No discussion allowed of COVID measures and next possible lockdown or what the virologists are saying on TV." I was pleasantly surprised when I read them, says Pacifici. In the other cafes I deliver to, it's a sea of sad faces and endless talk about COVID. Pacifici says he takes the virus very seriously. Much of Italy is under some degree of lockdown, with a national curfew of 10 p.m. and shops and cafes closing at 6. With Christmas around the corner, the government has already made it clear that extended family gatherings, so beloved to Italians, are out of the question. With COVID so dominating lives here, Pacifici and others say they're desperate for a little safe space from all the talk about it.
Allora, questa idea mi è venuta in modo molto semplice, anche spontaneo.
35-year-old cafe owner Cristina Mattioli says the idea to ban COVID talk came to her at the end of the summer when young people began returning from vacation infected. A lot of conversation at her counter was angry and accusatory about who was at fault for the rise in infections. It struck her that what used to be a place where strangers could gather, knock back an espresso, and chat about the weather or soccer had become a den of complaints. I wanted to return this space to what it was before, a place where people could relax and forget about their worries, she says. Hairdresser and regular Maurizio Cioccari spends his days listening to his own customers talk about COVID, some even questioning whether COVID is real. So his daily coffee break here has also become a respite from what he calls COVID confusion. So much COVID talk creates unnecessary alarmism, says another customer, Anna Graziano. It's a constant bombardment on TV, the papers, the radio, and it affects people psychologically. Owner Mattioli says since customers began following the protocol, the atmosphere has lightened. Beside the counter sits a little bell that says, "Ring for a kiss," a friendly touch from the pre-COVID era. She says she looks forward to the day when it's safe to respond to the ring. Megan Williams, DW, Rome.
And that's our show for this week. For more, go to dw.com/worldinprogress or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks very much from all of us in the studio, Celestine Fasicke and Christoph Grove, and me, Sarah Steffen. Bye for now.
CILU is supported in part by the students of Lakehead University, our sponsors, and our listeners. At this time, we would like to thank the following sponsors for their continuous support.
Campus Tech, located in the tunnels across from LUSU at Lakehead University. They are the only Apple-authorized service provider in northwestern Ontario. They also offer educational pricing on dozens of items, as well as a wide selection of computer and gaming accessories. Stop in and chat, or check out stock and order online at campustech.ca. Magnus Theatre, bringing a revolutionary season of live theatre to northwestern Ontario. Get your 2019-2020 tickets by visiting magnustheatre.com. The Argus, Lakehead University's student newspaper. Available on Wednesdays during the school year, around campus, around the city, or online at theargus.ca.
CILU now presents Living Planet.
DW, Living Planet, with Sam Baker.
Welcome to Living Planet. When it comes to the environment, politics has a big role to play. This is top of mind this week as the Paris Agreement enters its fifth year. But in recent years, some political sands have shifted. President Donald Trump formally pulled the U.S. out of the agreement just last month, making it the first and only country to do so. President-elect Joe Biden will reverse this decision, but what damage will remain to the U.S.'s environmental reputation? And what will its climate role be moving forward?
I think the rhetoric about U.S. leadership on the world stage on climate change rings a bit hollow right now. That is not a frame that world leaders are looking for. They're really looking for the U.S. to finally just start playing a responsible role. Join the fold of nations who is recognizing this complex global challenge and commit to taking serious action to cut its own emissions here domestically, as well as contribute to global efforts, including climate finance for developing countries.
And here in Germany, the Greens have really been gaining momentum, along with power in government in recent years. With conservative Chancellor Angela Merkel stepping down next year, might the Green Party have an even bigger role to play in shaping Germany's future? And then, we hear from one country that is top of the class when it comes to accomplishing their Paris Agreement goals.
For cars, for houses, heating, cooling systems, lighting, the technologies already exist. But what we need now are visions in government.
Stay tuned. One of the places where environmentalists, and in particular Green Party politicians, have really been able to gain a stronghold is right here in Germany. In EU elections this past May, the Greens gained 20% of the vote in Germany, twice as much as in 2014. And in local elections this September, a green wave swept through parts of Germany, including North Rhine-Westphalia, its most populous state. Not to mention the green mayors, who also rode this wave into power in small towns and large cities alike. This year, Bonn, the city where DW is based, got its first green mayor, Katja Jona. And with next year's elections, the Green Party looks like it's on the path to become the second strongest party in parliament. Here to explain a bit more about this Green Party rise to power in Germany and what it means on a more practical level for citizens and for the planet, I'm joined by DW's Neil King. Hi, Neil.
Thanks for having me, Sam. Real pleasure being here.
So what can you tell us about how the Green Party has come to gain so much power in Germany? I think it seems like it's really gained a bit more power than we've seen in other countries around the world anyway.
Oh, God, yeah. We have to go back a bit in history just to have a look at how they have developed, because the Green Party you see today in Germany is very different from how they set out in 1980. They were founded on a federal level. Back then, they were more like a movement. They weren't so much a party. They weren't so much interested in politics. It was more like an ecological and peace movement.
Kind of activist-y.
Yeah, okay. Far more activist-y. And if you look at them back then, the pictures, you know, they will look like, well, they stuck out in Parliament, let's put it like that. They look more like hippies.
Okay.
And they decided, they're going to join party politics. But inside this Green Party, there was a lot of friction because you had two very entrenched camps. One were called, in German, they called the Fundis. Those were like more the fundamentalist activist branch. And they were set against the Realos. And those are sort of more like an approach of common sense and compromise, and that they wanted to change the system from within. They weren't, you know, so averse to the establishment as the Fundis were, who didn't want to be part of the establishment even. And
so this is just within that one party.
Yeah, exactly. And this fight for the first decade of the existence of the Green Party in the 1980s, there was a struggle for power between these two factions. And it ended up with the Realos basically taking over and a lot of Fundis leaving the party. And that made the Greens palatable for the mainstream voter. Then they also joined the government under the Chancellor, the SPD Chancellor Gerhard Schröder, the Social Democrats. That was in 1998. And they were in power for the first time in German history in the Bundestag as a junior coalition partner.
So what do you think the key to success has been for the Green Party here in Germany?
There are two sides to this story. One side is, of course, that environmental topics are just becoming way, way more important. You know, if you look at surveys in Germany, over a quarter of the people see the climate crisis as the most pressing problem in Germany right now. So the Green Party obviously can benefit from that. Then the other thing is also the Fridays for Future movement in the past few years has galvanized, you know, environmental policies, also given the Greens a lot more support. So, you know, they're definitely riding this. It's a green wave, you could say, in Germany. And one of the reasons why this wave is also so strong is not just because of the Greens themselves, but because of the weakness of the other parties.
Mm.
So you have like parties, the Social Democrats or the Conservatives. They've been pretty much in crisis mode these past 10 years. You know, the days when they would achieve 40 plus at the ballot box, they're over. They don't get that anymore. And it's partly owed to the fact that these parties are faced with rival parties. And that is something the Greens, as yet, don't really face. They're still very, well, they haven't got a rival party, put it that way, yet, but there are rumblings at the bases.
2021 is going to be a big year for Germany. Merkel will be stepping down after 15 plus years at that point. Mm. What has her environmental legacy been?
I think Merkel is a very, very interesting figure in so many ways, because she's a very polarizing in many ways, but she's also hugely popular here in Germany. If you look at surveys, you know, 70% of Germans think Merkel's work has been good and that she's doing a good job.
And internationally as well. I think she has quite a positive reputation overall.
Yeah, I think perhaps internationally even more so. The problem that I see there is if you look at it in Germany, a lot of Germans feel, okay, internationally that reputation, Merkel subscribes to multilateralism, she's pushing for all these accords and she's happy to sign up to all these pledges of carbon neutrality and et cetera by 2050 and so forth. But when it translates into action at home, that's where environmentalists say she's falling short and that she's caving in to lobbyists, you know, from the car industry, for instance, or also that the coal phase out isn't ambitious enough. Germany has pledged to phase out coal no later than 2038. And environmentalists say this is way too late. Why can't she go the same way as she did with the nuclear, which was a real U-turn on Merkel's behalf? Again, this is also why she's such a polarizing figure, because just, you know, a year or two earlier, the parliament had pledged to extend the operation times for nuclear reactors in Germany. Then Fukushima happened, and suddenly Merkel says, oh, no, this is all off. We're going to phase out nuclear, and we're going to do it fast. That was something where a lot of people were very angry, also within her party, and where she faced a lot of stiff resistance, because they felt this was going too far and it was too rushed. It was a knee-jerk reaction. But yeah, so the bottom line is nuclear is going to be phased out by the end of 2022. The last reactors in Germany are going to come offline. Coal is going to be phased out by 2038. So you could see Merkel's legacy as being, she's a bit of a phase-out chancellor, if you like.
Speaking about what's actually been accomplished, what's getting phased out, we're coming up to the 5th anniversary of the Paris Climate Agreement. And I'm just wondering what concrete things have been achieved in Germany, either under Merkel's leadership or that the Greens have pushed in particular?
If we're looking at the phase out, for instance, or the carbon neutrality that's to be achieved, Germany hasn't achieved those targets. We have fallen short of that.
What are we likely to see coming back to the Greens in a post-Merkel Germany next year?
Yeah, well, next year is going to be really, really interesting. I was looking at the surveys, or the most recent surveys in Germany on the parties that came out just a couple of days ago. And three of these surveys, the most recent ones, they put the Greens at about 20% at the federal election next year.
Okay, and how does that compare to the other parties?
That's a lot. The Conservatives are forecast to make about 36% if it stays like this. And the Social Democrats, who used to be always, one of the largest parties in Germany, are at 16%. So they are going to come out smaller than the Greens. Now, if you look at coalition constellations, usually the Greens and the Social Democrats have been the perfect fit. They have governed together, in the past under Schröder, they governed together. But it looks like for next year that we might see a completely different constellation. Because the Conservatives and the Social Democrats, they are not going to form another grand coalition. Nobody wants that. The electorate doesn't want it. I think the parties themselves are tired of it as well. So they're going to try as best as they can to form a different coalition. They will need a coalition because no party is going to score an outright majority. That's just how it is. So it's quite possible we might see the first green conservative government in German history. And I think also looking at the general setup, with how this pandemic is panning out, I think there are a lot of people out there that are worried about their jobs. They're worried about the economy. At the same time, they're really worried about the climate crisis. And so with the German electoral system, where you can tick two boxes, you can choose your direct candidate and you can choose a party. Who knows? Maybe a lot of Germans next year might decide, I think I'm going to give something to the Greens and I'm going to give something to the Conservatives. Maybe they'll form a coalition. The one party will save my job and the other party will save the climate for me. Possible. I don't know. That's my crystal ball.
Yeah, well, it'll definitely be interesting to watch next year, that's for sure.
To hear more from Neil and about environmental topics in Germany, be sure to check out DW's podcast On the Green Fence. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. Now, turning to the U.S., the United States has been on a bit of a roller coaster in recent decades when it comes to climate policy. 5 years ago, the Obama administration helped shape the Paris Climate Accord. And then following the last presidential election this November, President Donald Trump withdrew the U.S. from the agreement. But with a new president coming into office in January, what does the future hold for environmental policy in the U.S.? I recently spoke with Rachel Cletus, Policy Director for Climate and Energy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. As someone who designs and advocates for policy at both the national and international level, Rachel Cletus knows a thing or two about what it takes to turn ideas into policy. I started out by asking her where we are right now after 4 years of the Trump administration when it comes to environmental policy.
Well, we're emerging from a pretty dark 4 years under a Trump administration that, frankly, completely sidelined science, in fact, lied about climate change, called it a hoax, and sidelined scientists and good scientific research to help us understand how to address the challenge of climate change. They rolled back numerous environmental policies, including any policies that had to do with limiting global warming emissions. There's a lot of ground we have to catch up on now.
Looking at these 4 years, what is Trump's environmental legacy coming out of his presidency?
The legacy of the Trump administration is, captured in a microcosm in them stepping away from the Paris Agreement. And it is a microcosm of
actions that this administration has taken, not just to overturn domestic climate policies, which they've done at every turn, but also to step away from a very hard-won international agreement that for the first time was having all the countries in the world working together to address this global challenge.
We often focus on the first 100 days of a new president's term. What are we likely to see in Biden's first 100 days coming up?
It's pretty clear that the Biden administration is going to come out right away with some very strong signals about addressing climate change for sure, but also addressing a range of environmental issues that have arisen during the Trump administration and have become worse. One big facet that they have sent a clear early signal around is that the Biden administration will center environmental justice in how they address many challenges, climate change as well as other pollution. The way we're seeing this already is in the kind of cabinet appointments that are being made, including John Kerry's role as a special climate envoy, but also the people who are being vetted for senior roles at the Environmental Protection Agency and other key areas of influence and power in the administration.
What can you tell us about the overall climate team that Biden is building?
Well, what's really interesting is John Kerry, clearly as special climate envoy, has deep experience in climate change. But what we're also noticing is that other appointees who are either being vetted or have been announced do understand the challenge of climate change. So take Janet Yellen, for example, who's been announced to Treasury Secretary. That is a very powerful role. And she is someone, again, who has spoken about climate change, the fact that it is an economic threat here in the U.S. and around the world. So these are the kind of signals, recognizing that people in positions, whether it's in public health, the economy, or directly in climate, these are all connected. And we must have people who recognize how climate change touches every aspect of our economy and our lives.
You're listening to Living Planet on CILU 102.7 FM.
And you mentioned there John Kerry being appointed to this special presidential envoy for climate role that will sit on the National Security Council as well. What does this appointment of Kerry mean for international cooperation when it comes to addressing climate change?
We expect that having him at the helm means that we now have someone who's a strong champion of the science, who understands how to work in cooperation with other countries in a spirit of mutual respect. During his tenure under the Obama administration, worked very skillfully to address a range of geopolitical issues, including the nuclear issue with Iran, the Paris Agreement. This is also a moment where we have to understand that 5 years have passed since the Paris Agreement. We're not talking about simply going back in time. In fact, the climate crisis has gotten even more dire. So John Kerry will have to do a lot more. And I think it's past time for the U.S. to take its place at the table of responsible global leaders and contribute a fair share.
I want to come to Congress. What pressure or resistance might the Biden administration face from the more progressive side of the Democratic Party when it comes to environmental policy?
I am not a Democratic Party insider, so really can't say much about that. What I can say is that it's pretty clear that the climate movement is a very broad and diverse movement right now in the United States, as it is around the world. But here in the U.S., it's been really striking to see that we now have a coalition that includes everybody from scientists. I'm with the Union of Concerned Scientists. But it's not just scientists, it's young people, it's faith leaders, it's labor leaders, it's community activists, environmental justice leaders. And this broad Big Tent coalition is what it's going to take to win ambitious climate action. Now, of course, when you have a coalition this broad, everybody's bringing some important strength to it and everybody has a different perspective on some of the policy details. But there's broad unity about the agenda. And the agenda is bold climate action, not incrementalism. We don't have time to waste. When you look at the most recent science, it's so sobering in terms of what needs to happen in the next 10 years to cut emissions so that we still have a chance of staying within the goals of the Paris Agreement. So with that as the frame, there are so many positive actions that can be taken that I think focusing on a narrow slice of this that's about divisions doesn't seem to do justice to the moment we're actually in.
I mean, there have been activists and even some Congress members who have said, we're supporting Joe Biden, but we have to hold him to account when it comes to policies. So I'm curious to see if that will lead to disagreements or fights on certain matters when it comes to getting things passed, especially through Congress.
Policymakers will always need to have their feet held to the fire because they, on a day-to-day basis, are juggling multiple priorities, hearing from many different constituencies, and might waver. So yes, everybody needs to hold the Biden administration's feet to the fire. It's not as if we've turned the page from the Trump administration and now everything will happen seamlessly. This is part of what it means to hold our leaders accountable in a democracy, and I expect that the Biden administration will expect that. So yes, I fully expect that there will be pressure on them, and that pressure will be a good sign.
Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you so much, Sam. Nice talking to you.
That was Rachel Cletus, Policy Director for Climate and Energy at the Union of Concerned Scientists.
Just a little bit harder.
The Kingdom of Morocco might not be the first country that comes to mind when you think of climate-forward policies. But according to the Climate Action Tracker, which grades countries based on how well they're acting on their Paris commitments, Morocco is one of just two countries, along with Gambia, actually on track to meet its goals and limit warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. The country is currently building the world's largest solar plant, high up in its sun-rich mountains. It was 2009 that King Mohammed VI called for a makeover of the country's energy sector. So, what has the North African country achieved since then? From landing the first solar airplane in Rabat to green mosques, Stefan Ehlert went to find out. This report is presented by Charlie Shield.
Mais écoutez, le vol lui-même était absolument merveilleux.
The flight was marvelous, enthuses pilot Bertrand Picard as he steps out of the cockpit of his Solar Impulse in the middle of the night in July 2012. He had just completed the first intercontinental journey of a purely solar-powered plane, 20 hours from Madrid in Spain to Rabat in Morocco.
You know, the most beautiful moment was, of course, Gibraltar, from one continent to the other continent.
Von ein Kontinent bis ein anderer Kontinent.
Picard, as he openly admits, may as well be employed as an advertising agent for the climate-neutral power of the sun.
Für Wagen, für Häuser,
for cars, for houses, heating, cooling systems, lighting. The technologies already exist, but what we need now are visions in government.
Visionen in Regierungen.
The Kingdom of Morocco has been pursuing this vision for several years now. King Mohammed VI ordered the energy sector to decarbonize back in 2009. He didn't want to wait around for multinational businesses to bring renewable energy to the country. But the foundations of this climate-forward shift go back further still. The current Moroccan Prime Minister, Saad Eddine El Othmani, attended the Cornerstone Rio Earth Summit as a prince in 1992. It's in large part thanks to El Othmani that Morocco is now considered a pioneer in Africa when it comes to introducing green electricity. The country hopes to achieve 40% renewable energy use this year,
In 10 years, it plans to generate more than 50% of its energy from climate-neutral sources. That means getting away from expensive imports. At the moment, Morocco still relies on electricity imports from Spain that could soon be a thing of the past. The construction of new coal-fired power plants will also help Morocco become energy independent, even though not all of them may end up being needed. That's in part because now there's Ouarzazate, currently the world's largest solar power plant, located in the south of the country. This power plant alone can supply more than 1 million people with electricity, explains Mustafa Bakouri, the Moroccan Agency for Sustainable Energy.
We are doing everything to make this first project a complete success. It's a high-quality project in terms of technology, implementation, and financing. It's about innovation and also about a reasonable price for this new energy.
In the meantime, a much larger solar power plant has long been under construction in Medelt, a town in central Morocco in the high plains between the middle and high Atlas mountain ranges. And large it is. Stretching over a landmass bigger than 4,000 soccer fields, the solar power plant will have the capacity of a medium-sized coal-fired power plant. It's being financed mostly with the help of foreign loans. Many people are hopeful that this billion-euro investment will improve their lives. Supposedly, Morocco is now almost 100% electrified. But in the mountains near Medelt, people still live in huts without electricity and worry about earning enough money to survive.
There are a lot of unemployed people. There's a high unemployment rate.
High unemployment and slim opportunities for development. All of this, Hassan Haj hopes, will change with the new solar power plant. He's the elected head of a municipal council in the Medelt district. An enormous project with enormous economic potential. That's how the mayor describes it. Morocco is known for expensive prestige projects. The Opera of Rabat, the express TGV train, the highest high-rise building in Africa. And now, for the second time, the largest solar power plant in the world. Some Moroccans have their doubts as to whether these big-ticket projects will really move the country forward and give people the help where they need it most. The price of electricity is still too high for some people, even though it's subsidized and there's no fee for kilowatt hours. In light of this, and in an effort to convince the renewable energy skeptics, the Moroccan government has made great strides to sell the idea of solar power to its people. It wants to show them how solar power could change their lives for the better. One example is the so-called green mosques. Since 2015, hundreds of mosques have had solar panels installed on their roofs, both in an attempt to introduce the faithful to the principle of solar energy and, of course, to save energy costs. With 55,000 mosques in the country, this seems like a fitting place to start, says energy expert Jan-Christoph Kunze.
I believe this project is a very important part of the Moroccan energy turnaround. This project tries to enlighten different parts of the Moroccan population to the advantages of energy efficiency and renewable energies. It does so via people, such as imams and teachers in Quran schools.
As for mosques where there isn't an electricity connection at all, as is the case for many mosques in the high and middle Atlas Mountains, no one can complain that a light suddenly switched on in the middle of prayer or that the water prescribed for holy washings has run hot. More and more farmers in the agricultural countryside of Morocco are realizing that they can irrigate their melons more cheaply if they run the pumps on solar power rather than diesel. So that the installation and maintenance of this technology can be provided by Moroccan technicians, training schools for renewable energies are popping up nationwide, and thousands are applying for training. They want their professional futures tied to the energies of the future. They want to become their own bosses, build biogas plants, maintain wind turbines, and install solar pumps.
For me personally, I founded a company because it did not exist yet in Morocco.
I'd like to create my own business, and thanks to the injection, we will see a return on investment.
A technician says that thanks to the compensation for electricity fed into the grid, investing in green electricity will pay off too. Surpluses could be sold and fed into the grid once everybody gets access to do so. Young people are also learning how to save energy, which is the last piece Morocco urgently needs if it wants to achieve climate neutrality. LED lights, more efficient heating and cooling, better modes of transportation, plus housing installation. With all of these changes, Morocco might just manage to reduce its own demands fast enough to become an exporter of energy instead of an importer.
That report by Stefan Ehlert was presented by Charlie Shield.
Here comes the sun, little darling.
And that's all for us this week. Don't forget to subscribe to Living Planet if you haven't already. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we would love to hear your thoughts on environmental politics where you live. You can send them to us at livingplanet@dw.com. Thanks this week to Jürgen Kuhn and Celestine Wasike in the studio, and to Inika Mules and Sonia Dean, who helped with production. I'm Sam Baker. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with more environment stories from around the globe.
As the COVID-19 pandemic continues to spread, it is important to stay safe. Coronavirus is now in Canadian provinces and territories. By law, if you've traveled abroad recently, you must self-isolate. To do your part, stay home as much as possible and practice social distancing. Try to maintain at least 2 meters away from others. Encourage those who are sick or showing symptoms to self-isolate or to seek medical attention. As always, wash your hands frequently, avoid touching your face, and practice good respiratory etiquette by covering your coughs and sneezes. Clean regularly used